Okay, let me first of all welcome everyone here. This is the Global Dynamics seminar on, or tutorial, I guess it's supposed to be called, on human rights in the information age. Delighted to have you with us. My name is Jim Woolsey. I'm moderating the panel. Somebody has a BlackBerry on somewhere near a microphone. It might be me. Often guilty, but not this. Yes, I may be. BlackBerries, even when you think you have them off, they still interfere with things. So, anyway, welcome, and we're delighted to have you with us. Bios are in the program, so I won't go into them much, except to say that our two principal speakers today are extraordinarily well qualified. Michael Posner is president of Human Rights First. He's been a leading voice in human rights in the U.S. and internationally for 25 years or more. Played a major role in helping get the McCain Amendment passed last year. He's very active behind the Fair Labor Association, an effort to address supply chain working conditions in industry, and we're delighted to have him. I'm going to ask Samantha Power to speak first. Samantha, I imagine most of you know, is a professor of human rights practice at JFK School at Harvard, and many of you know her through her magnificent book, A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide, which won the Pulitzer Prize in 2003 and the National Book Critics Award, and on and on and on. I'm going to ask Samantha to go first. I think we'll have a chance for a fair amount of dialogue here because we're here for an hour and a half, and with only two speakers, I will chime in a bit here right at the beginning, but the main speakers are the two individuals on either side of me. Let me just say one introductory word about the overall subject. In 1945, there were 20 democracies in the world. Today, these are Freedom House numbers, there are almost exactly 120, 90 of them operating under the rule of law, another 30 with serious problems with the rule of law, like corruption, say, in Indonesia, but nonetheless regular elections. There are another 30 or so governments that Freedom House rates as partly free, which tend to be places which are not democracies but are ruled in a fashion in which there may be some violations of human rights, but one thinks of them as in a more complicated way than the remaining 40 or so governments in the world, not free, which constitute the dictatorships and autocratic kingdoms in which human rights are regularly oppressed by the government, sometimes within their borders, sometimes without. Human rights in the information age is not, however, solely a question of dictatorial or highly authoritarian governments. It is also an issue that arises through ethnic and other tensions underlying horrors such as genocide, for example, Rwanda and Darfur and others. It is also quite possible to have your human rights violated by someone flying an airplane into a building where you are working, so we do not want to focus exclusively on governments here. There are many now possibilities for terrorist attack and action, which are themselves, I think, a very important human rights issue. And then, of course, there are the 120 or so democracies, including our own, who are generally on the side of human rights, but sometimes do not proceed satisfactorily, to put it mildly. And all of these types of actors have their effectiveness and their ineffectiveness potentially enhanced by the developments of the information age. In China, if you want to be optimistic, you will look at the hackers and the young people and the human rights advocates who were in part sustained by clever use of information technology inside the country. If you want to wrinkle your brow, you will, of course, look at the policies of the Chinese government and its restrictions on freedom of speech and the Internet, and from time to time, the behavior of Western corporations, including American corporations, which may give them a hand in that sort of repression. So we have a wide range of activities by governments and non-governmental organizations, some of them positive, some of them negative, all of them in one way or another influenced by the information age. And with that, I'm going to ask Samantha if she would start. Well, then as soon as she finishes, we'll turn to Michael, throw it open to some questions back and forth between them if they so choose, but the bulk of our time we'll reserve for questions and short statements, short from those of you here in the center. Samantha?
Thank you so much, Jim. What many of you probably don't know about Jim Woolsey, maybe, or you probably do if you've been to a panel or two of his here, but is that he's becoming one of the leading advocates for the electric car. And I just learned, and I just wanted to share with you before starting, that on one of his cars, he has a bumper sticker that I think should become a bumper sticker for the 21st century, which is simply, Bin Laden hates this car. So, and I'm trying to help spread the wealth and the wisdom here. What I thought I would do is just two things. One, talk about the categories or the ways in which I think we can think about the effect of information on human rights. And then second, to talk more specifically and briefly about the United States and what we're seeing about or what we're seeing in the Bush administration's relationship to information, its mistrust of information, at a time when it feels obviously under siege and under threat, and which parallels analogously, not directly of course, some of what we see in developing countries where most of the time we are talking about human rights or have been talking about human rights in the past. So when I was thinking, just for the sake of this panel, about the effects of information on human rights, I broke it down in my mind. I'm sure there are more categories than those that I've come up with, but into six categories. One, enabling, which I'll talk about. Two, mobilizing. Three, pluralizing. Four, demonizing. Five, diluting. And six, daunting. And so in talking about each of these briefly, I'm going to talk mainly about societies where human rights are manifestly under siege. So first, enabling. To what degree is information an enabler? Well, Amartya Sen, the now Harvard economist, famously found that no country with a free press had ever suffered a substantial famine. Now, there's been all kinds of scholarship trying to rebut this, and so he's modified. It used to be no country with a free press had ever suffered a famine, and now it's substantial famine. but his idea here is that in the human rights community, there tends to be a dichotomy between those who talk about leading with social and economic rights, leading with full stomachs or healthcare, antiretroviral medicines, et cetera, and those who talk about freedom of movement, freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, freedom of religion. He said, enough with this dichotomy. Let's be clear, if people can actually speak up, they will have then the ability to mobilize on behalf of more equitable distribution of resources. So again, the idea is, if you actually have the capacity to protest governmental policies that would give rise to mass death with regard to famine, you're much more likely to deter a government from behaving in that way. So the idea here is that information is a kind of enabler to greater sort of distributive, in that case, justice. Second, I think the way that Mike is probably going to talk more about, mobilizing. To what degree is the 21st century information bounty actually helping human rights activists do their bidding around the world? And, it's no secret that the Internet has created networks across borders that were unthinkable before. But I'd just like to give a couple examples of things that you literally would not have seen happen, I don't think, if you didn't have the ability to cross borders. The first is with regard to antiretroviral medicines and AIDS treatment.
In the, once antiretroviral treatment became available in this country, it was hailed, of course, for the incredible innovation that it was, the life-saving, I mean, even hailed as a cure, which it didn't prove to be. But it, of course, cost $20,000 a year for a regimen of triple therapy for HIV-positive Americans. How in the world, then, when HIV began tearing through the continent of Africa, could one begin to imagine that HIV-positive Africans would have access to this kind of treatment? And if they didn't have access to treatment, what would their incentive be to go and get tested to, in turn, service prevention? You know, if they didn't know they were HIV-positive, why would they use a condom, et cetera? So treatment is an indispensable part, of course, of the prevention story as well. Well, one of the things that happened was in the late 1990s, on the tail end of the Clinton administration, drug companies in this country were very reluctant to bring the prices down, even in the developing world. And a group, a network called the Treatment Action Campaign, came into existence in sub-Saharan Africa, teamed up over the internet with intellectual property lawyers in North America, and ACT UP activists who were suddenly living in a way that in the 80s they would never have imagined being able to live with HIV/AIDS, many of whom were younger and actually felt guilty that they hadn't been through the sort of crucible movement of getting the Reagan administration to focus on HIV when it was, at its height of crisis and also of governmental indifference or neglect, and what you got was this transnational network in which ACT UP activists here protested, picketed pharmaceutical companies, which in turn, owing to the shame and so on, end up bringing drug prices down. The intellectual property lawyers provided the legal expertise so that those same activists in sub-Saharan Africa were actually able to file court cases in South Africa in particular, calling on Thabo Mbeki to define the right to health and to health care by including antiretrovirals and specifically the drug that prevents mother-to-child transmission of HIV. All of this inconceivable even just 10 years before. And you couldn't have had any piece of this movement being functional without the other piece, and no one of these pieces, or all three of these pieces, weren't available, you know, in one domestic setting. And so that's just one example. Darfur, an obvious contemporary example. 75,000 Americans gathered on the Mall in Washington on April 30th of this year to protest the Bush administration's policy on Darfur, to try to get it to do more. These are 75,000 people. This didn't get many headlines because next to the immigration protests and so on, what are 75,000 people? But when you think about it, these were 75,000 people, not one of whom practically, and there were probably 500 people from Sudan, but apart from them, maybe a dozen or two had ever actually met a person from Darfur. 75,000 people who were protesting something that had absolutely nothing to do with them at all. And that came about as a result, again, of one of these internet networks. Another example, one of the things that came to light about 9 months ago was that the State Department, which had issued a genocide finding around Sudan's behavior in Darfur, had actually created an exemption for a lobbyist to represent the Sudanese government in the United States at a rate of $500,000 a year. This lobbyist was being paid by the Sudanese, and this was should have been a violation of U.S. sanctions, but an exemption was made by the State Department. The day that this was leaked to the Washington Post, the students who were based, Students Against Genocide or Genocide Intervention Network, who were based in Washington, looked up on the internet where this lobbyist, who was a Washington-based lobbyist, lived, sent out a mass alert to all the D.C.-based students, and they basically began putting up posters, flyers, on the telephone poles in his neighborhood that were the equivalent of sexual predator alerts. So basically the message was, there goes the neighborhood. You know, you have a lobbyist for a genocidal government, in your neighborhood. And within 2 weeks of that campaign, again, which was only made possible, or at least in that kind of rapid form, by the internet, he had resigned his position as lobbyist for the Sudanese government, maybe to be replaced at some later date. In the realm of mobilizing as well, of course, I've been talking about the internet mainly, but the CNN effect is notorious for the pull factor, and for the possibility it creates of narrowing distances between those of us who live in relative comfort and those of us who don't. I'll come in a second to the sort of negative aspects of the CNN effect, but certainly You could argue that the CNN effect is necessary, although by no means sufficient, to drawing Western governments and to attracting them to human rights crises and to convincing them to mobilize resources on behalf of combating these kinds of abuses. Pluralizing, you know, in places where atrocities happen, this again gets to Amartya Sen's point, it is often in places where information is centralized and is controlled. A friend of mine, Alexei Sinduhija, who's Burundi's great human rights activist, sort of the Mandela-to-be of Burundi, created something called African Public Radio, because Burundi had traditionally only had one radio source. And, of course, in Rwanda, the fact that Rwandans only got their radio from Radio Milkaline, which became hate radio in the middle of the genocide, convinced Alexei that in the wake of that genocide in his neighboring country, that the best thing he could do to stave off atrocity would be to create a competing radio network. And that's what he did. And about 2.5-3 years ago, when the government of Pierre Buyoya, basically in the interest of sort of trying to hijack the democratic process or the pluralizing process, announced that there'd been a military coup, which was untrue, but he announced that as a way of justifying a kind of crackdown, Alexei took to the airwaves on African Public Radio, and he had sort of cultivated his base by airing principally soap operas and local music in order to build a constituency over time, not wanting it to be political right off the bat, but in that moment of crisis was able to take to the airwaves and to compete with government radio and say that, in fact, no such coup had occurred and the alarm, the false alarm, such as it was derailed. Demonizing, here I get to the negative effects, of course, of information and the enhanced technology. Rwandan hate radio has now become a poster child for the peril of modernity. And you know, if the Holocaust was the first great testament to mechanization and the way it could be used in the tools of, or in the hands of the wrong people with the wrong agenda, so too hate radio and the ability to demonize one's foes and the over-reliance that certain populaces have, especially in the developing world, on radio or on technology as they skip over newspapers, now on cell phones as they skip over landlines, it testified, of course, to the you know, very deadly effect that greater information can have if there aren't multiple sources of it. Diluting. What does it mean when we have so many sources of information that we can no longer... You know, it used to be that if there was sort of one-stop shopping, if you were a human rights advocate, if you could just get on the evening news, if you could somehow convince Jennings or Rather or Brokaw to take your issue seriously, if some human rights activist could become person of the week, you know, it was a windfall to drawing attention, governmental attention, as well as public constituency attention to a particular crisis. Now what do we do? You know, where do you go in the blogosphere and, you know, in 24-hour news cycles? And then daunting. I mentioned earlier the sort of potential pull factor of the CNN effect, but in the heads and in the hearts of Western governments, and Jim Woolsey and I were talking about this earlier, but the CNN effect is also a specter. It's the recognition that if you get involved in the developing world on the basis of mere human rights, let's say to stop genocide or to defuse atrocity or to ease repression or to democratize or wherever you're there, you have the CNN effect. The CNN effect may have brought you there, as it did perhaps to Somalia, but it's also the first thing that will drive you out, because at the first sign of trouble, you know, there will be great transparency. It will broadcast right into the American living room. Okay, briefly, final point before handing it over to Mike. You know, one of the things that when one thinks about information, and I think many of the examples that I've given reflect this, information is a prime way of weakening state control. And the corollary of that is that weak or fearful states are afraid of information. And one of the things that's happened, of course, in the wake of 9/11 is that we've seen this at work at home. We talk a lot about Putin and his crackdown on the media. We talk a lot about Robert Mugabe and how the first thing he did, you know, when he was doing farm seizures was to blow up the Daily News, you know, Zimbabwe's one independent newspaper. But one of the things we've seen here, again, not talking about technology, but information itself, is that the U.S. government has this wonderful thing called the Freedom of Information Act, without which I could not have written A Problem from Hell. Over the years, you have regular declassification that occurs, of course, just by time and calendar. But over the years, advocates have tried to make a point of convincing American administrations to release more documents sooner, not only so we can learn from our history, but so that these documents can then be pumped into developing or transitional societies that are themselves reckoning with their dictatorships or with their repressive phases. And for many, many years, through successive administrations, the standard rate of declassification was about 20,000 documents a year, 20,000 early declassification. I'm sorry, 200,000 or early declassification, so not by calendar. One of the things that happened the second term of the Clinton administration is that the National Security Archive in Washington and other advocates managed to convince certain elements in the administration to rapidly ramp up the amount of declassification that occurred. And so that 200,000 figure rose to 2 million documents a year of early declassification. And this had an incredible effect, because what would happen was these documents would make their way back into Chile or into Mexico or into Guatemala. Remember the School of America's disclosures and all of these things. They would go back into the society, and suddenly journalists and citizens in these societies would start to demand greater openness and greater accessibility and transparency in their own societies and investigations of militias and death squads and things like that. Too much technology in this room at this moment. So this was a sort of high watermark, and perhaps it was unrealistic to think that it could be sustained. But one of the things that's happened is that President Bush, of course, has ramped that way back down. He's actually not releasing fewer documents than were released prior to this spike. He's back down to the 200,000 pages. I had thought, or 200,000 documents. I had thought that it was much, much lower. But of course, what he has attempted to do is reclassify documents that had been declassified for anywhere from 10 to 50 years. And so we see, again, this sort of hoarding, this sense that information is threatening. And rather than seeing information as a boon and as a source of innovation and entrepreneurship and plurality and all the things that we're sort of encouraging abroad, we're starting to see it as a threat. And the other example, just in closing, is, of course, the debates that we managed to have in our society about the balancing act between liberty and security are debates that have been brought about not by congressional investigations, hearings that are not actually occurring, given that one party controls both the executive branch and the legislature, but Abu Ghraib came about because of Cy Hirsch and 60 Minutes. The Gulag and the rendition stories came about because of Dana Priest and Jane Mayer. And, of course, the eavesdropping or National Security Agency story came about because of James Risen. One of the questions I have, and I think all of us have right now, as there is a backlash against these kinds of disclosures by the executive branch, is in an ideal world, when leaks occur, it becomes a boon to the democratic process, a boon to the kind of debate, maybe an incentivizer of congressional investigations. But in this instance, of course, when Dana Priest published her kind of landmark story about these undisclosed sites where prisoners were being held without any visits from Red Cross or anybody else, the Republican, the chair of the relevant committee, came out the very next day and said that he did want to launch an investigation, but not into the gulags, into Dana Priest and into the leaks themselves. And that has been that was sort of the beginning of the sign of the approach that the executive branch would in turn take, and that we're seeing now, which I'm sure Jim has lots of thoughts on that are probably a little bit different than mine. But we're in a moment now where the chilling effect on leakers who have proven indispensable to us to know about Abu Ghraib, to know about gulags, to know about rendition, and the protections for whistleblowers, which seem to be atrophying, I think underscore really how essential information actually is in what amounts to an excruciating and what will certainly be a long-term balancing act that I happen not to believe we're balancing right at present. And without information, I don't know where we go from there, and I certainly don't know how we preach transparency, information, accountability in other countries where we've been trying to promote human rights in recent decades. Thank you.
Thanks, Samantha. If everyone would follow not my example, since I left my BlackBerry on and it started interfering with the microphone at the beginning of this, but the example of those of you who have turned off your cell phones and pagers, please do so. And Michael, you're up.
Thank you. I want to try to do three things here by way of introduction. One is to just say a few words about human rights in the pre-information age, because all the things that have been accomplished over the last 60 years, I think, are quite remarkable. And a lot of them were the result of hard work by diplomats, by non-governmental people, by people in governments. And I think we need to take a moment to reflect. People always say to me, you know, how do you keep working in such a depressing field? I actually have a very different view. I think we've accomplished an incredible amount in the last 60 years, and we need to take a moment to reflect on that. Second thing I want to do is talk about some of the challenges of the new information technology, and then third, talk about some of the opportunities that present themselves to overcome some challenges. On the history, let me just mention four things. In the world of World War II, or the world coming out of World War II, the assumption had been that what a government does to its own people is its own business. It's part of the reason we had a Holocaust. And quite remarkably, and with tremendous leadership from individuals like Eleanor Roosevelt, when the UN was created, it was created really to do two things: to create a collective response on peace and security issues, and secondly, to promote human rights. And the first important thing that Eleanor Roosevelt and her colleagues did in the 40s was to say two things. One is that there are universal standards of human rights that belong to everyone, regardless of where they live and where they're a citizen. They universalize the concept. You don't torture people. You don't disappear people. You don't arbitrarily imprison them or execute them. The second thing they did was to internationalize it, to say this is the business of governments. And it's not only the business of governments to protect their own people, it's the business of every other government to make sure that some minimum standards are followed. The creation of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948 was the symbolic emblem of both of those things, again, led by Eleanor Roosevelt in the United States. The second thing that happened in over 25 or 30 years, beginning in the late 40s, is that governments sought to basically, through the United Nations, to create a series of laws and rules that would apply. We're not just going to talk in abstractions. We're going to say there are certain civil rights that are applicable to all, certain economic and social rights. There's a convention against torture, another on the elimination of discrimination against women, another on elimination of racial discrimination, genocide, torture. And with great difficulty, there has been a beginning in the last 15 years of creating means of accountability. Tribunal on the former Yugoslavia that brought Milosevic to trial. Tribunal on Rwanda that brought a number of senior government officials to trial. An ad hoc or a hybrid tribunal in Sierra Leone that brought Charles Taylor to the dock and now has him in The Hague. And an international criminal court, which is looking at, among other things, the atrocities in the Congo and Darfur. All of that is, I would say, at an experimental stage, but it represents an amazing evolution from where we were in 1945. The third thing that happened that is equally extraordinary and I think more important is that people like us, said, you know what, governments are never going to do this easily. They're going to have to be pushed. No government makes this their top priority, and every government has a national interest, which in some instances precludes their taking these things seriously. And so government action, I think when governments created the UN and they created the treaties, their thought was this was going to be a club, and government diplomats in a very comfortable setting were going to kind of have quiet conversations. And people said, let's take this out of the hands of government. And so with the creation of Amnesty International in 1961 and then a range of other organizations, including the one I work for, there has been another actor brought into the fold. And most important, by far the most important element, is that people in their own societies are saying these things are just too important to be left to our governments or to anybody else in the world. So if you're in India or you're in Zimbabwe or you're in Darfur or you're in Russia, today there are people working actively for human rights really on the front line. Their voices are the most important, and I'm going to come back to some of what it means to them to have a technologically wired world. All of this has meant that human rights has a place at the table, And it's meant that we've seen real change, not entirely because of these things, but they played a part. We no longer have an apartheid state in South Africa. The Soviet bloc has collapsed. When I started working in human rights, almost every government in Latin America was a military dictatorship. Today, it's a very different scene. So while we can bemoan and worry about lots of problems in the world, and God knows there are a lot of problems in the world, it is also important to reflect back on what's been accomplished in a very short period of time. 60 years is a very short period of time. The United States has been a leader in that, and it's helped to empower the UN, it's worked with the UN, and there is, I have to say, now a crisis of in two ways. One is that the United States' actions, and we can talk about this later, with respect to the post 9/11 security issues have crippled our moral standing in the world, made it very difficult for the United States to do what it's done traditionally in the realm of human rights. It makes our work enormously more difficult. And the second thing is that I think the United States is not doing what it can do and what it should do to make the United Nations a stronger voice for human rights. And you know, maybe Shashi Tharoor will say something about that when we get to questions. But I think we have a real moment of crisis here where we have to take a look at our own role in the world. Now let me say just a couple words about some of the challenges that technology brings. One, which is obvious, but and Jim mentioned it at the beginning, I want to emphasize it again. There are very dangerous groups like Al-Qaeda in the world that take a kind of jujitsu approach to things. They take our technology, whether it's information technology to communicate, to amplify their propaganda, or it's our transportation technology, airplanes, or it's our weapons, and they use them against us. That's a feature of the world today, and we're going to see more of it. So when we think of technology as a good and a bad thing, there clearly are lots of bad forces in the world, private groups as well as some governments that are using the same technology for bad purposes, and we've got to be responsive to that, and we've got to figure out ways to control that. It's not going to be easy. Second thing is that governments are afraid of technology, and Samantha said this, and Orville Schell in his panel earlier today talked about the Chinese government's unbelievable efforts to control the internet. In 1996 or 97, there were 60,000 people using the internet in China. Now there are about 110 million. And the Chinese government is freaking out. And they have about 30,000 people on the government payroll basically trying to track what's going on the internet and trying to block what's happening. They're putting the screws to big American and other global information technology companies like Microsoft and Google and Yahoo to control their search engines and make sure that when you go to the site, the Google CN site, and look for Tiananmen Square, you see people wandering across a peaceful Tiananmen Square. And so there is a challenge that we face. And the Chinese example, while maybe the most dramatic because it's a big, important country, they're not alone. Governments are very nervous about information. And those that control have a tendency to want to control information feel that in spades when it comes to the internet and new technologies. The third challenge we face is in our own society and elsewhere, and Samantha talked about this too, but I'll mention it briefly, that when in an environment where national security becomes a higher priority, we flip traditional notions of openness in government and personal privacy. The history of this country is built on a notion that government is as open as it can be. Madison said popular government without popular information or the means of acquiring it is a prologue to farce or tragedy or both. The Freedom of Information Act that Samantha says very much talked about is very much in the spirit of Madison's comment. We've always believed that an informed population, an informed Congress, makes for better government. And on the flip side, we've always believed that government ought to stay out of the way of people in their private lives. This administration, and what Vice President Cheney calls the new normal, has flipped those two propositions on their head. and said, in effect, that government ought to control as much information as it can when it relates, however tangentially, to what they consider national security. So there's been a dramatic scaling back of the Freedom of Information Act, particularly in relation to military and intelligence, law enforcement. And on the other side, there's been a ramping up of government intrusion into individual record keeping, the data mining that was the Total Information Awareness Act, the Patriot Act, the NSA disclosures, et cetera. The United States is not alone in this, and lots of governments are following what we do. So there are challenges to us and to governments with respect to governments around the world to make sure the government's open and that personal privacy is protected. Three thoughts about opportunities. I want to come back to the Chinese example. I mentioned Google and Microsoft and Yahoo. What's interesting about that example, and Orville knows this better than I, is that companies, the internet companies that are doing business in China, are basically information providers. They're in the business of promoting a free flow of information. And they're highly anxious about their current relationship with the Chinese government. Some of us are talking to those companies. There's a group called the Center for Democracy and Technology, which has convened some sessions between non-governmental people, technology experts, and these companies to talk about what are the rules of the road, what are the ways in which companies ought to behave with respect to governments like the Chinese that want to limit access to information. I think there's a real opportunity there. These are not companies that are turning their back on us, although I will say that Yahoo, in a particularly unfortunate incident, handed over the names of a couple of bloggers that were there in their files to the Chinese government, and the government prosecuted those people under draconian Chinese law. Part of what we're talking about is how to prevent those sorts of incidents in the future, do no harm. Second example, also relating to companies, is the work we've done, and Jim mentioned it, with the Fair Labor Association. We're working with about 20 big manufacturing, mostly American and European manufacturers in the apparel and footwear industry, who are outsourcing products in 35 countries, about 3,500 factories among these companies, Nike, Reebok, Adidas, Nordstrom's, H&M, companies you've heard of. They've agreed in a multi-stakeholder initiative to allow monitoring of their factories by independent experts, and the posting of the results of those factory visits on a website, which is fairlabor.org. That, to me, is an interesting example, and we're going to see more of it as we, again, try to create rules of the road for human rights, labor rights, environmental issues, et cetera, where there are means of transporting information and making information transparent to a greater public. We ought to be looking for ways to do that and ways to marry what the human rights community and what companies feel they mutually can benefit from doing. It was not an easy thing to get companies to put their dirty laundry on the internet. But having done it, they now recognize that there is a value in having that information out there. It provides a sense of credibility. Last point, and in a way the largest point, and Samantha touched on it, but for the non-governmental community, both in the United States, Europe, but most importantly around the world, the new technology has been absolutely vital in reinforcing and amplifying our mission. It's now possible for a lone human rights advocate in Darfur to get on a cell phone or to get on a computer or to paste something on an email to video stream information in a matter of minutes to groups like ours or to Amnesty International or to Human Rights Watch, to get it out to the world, to get it out to the world's news media, to shine a spotlight on what's going on, to amplify the voices of these groups, and most importantly, perhaps, to mobilize public outrage and public action. We are now relying much more, and it's a great equalizer, on the power of email lists and e-communications and e-activism as a way to generate publicity, to generate attention, to put pressure on elected leaders to say, these are issues you can no longer afford to ignore. So I think there is a sense of popular participation today, or the potential for it, which is far beyond what we ever thought of 10 years ago, and it holds in some ways the greatest hope for making these issues more important on the global stage, but also to get results. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michael. Those were two superb presentations. Let me just make one point explicit that I alluded to, and the others have as well, but it seems to me any discussion of these issues is not effective without it. Samantha talked about enabling and referred to the wonderful work of Amartya Sen, who talks about institutions of public reason in lots of societies, the Loya Jirga in Afghanistan, for example, which, although not directly related to balloting, are institutions of consensus, of discussion, of consensual as distinct from either balloting or certainly authoritarian decision-making. And that the big difference is between societies where you can build on those institutions of public reason and those where you can't. He very movingly talks, for example, about the decision-making in African villages and the tradition of discussion there. Nathan Sharansky says something the same thing along the same lines when he refers to the difference between societies are those where if you can walk down to the village square, criticize whoever is governing, walk home, go to sleep comfortably at night, that's one kind of society. The other kind are very different. What I meant to allude to by talking about how we had gone from 20 to 120 democracies since 1945 is that sometimes it is necessary to use the tools of war or authority or power in order to advance the cause of institutions of public reason. Shashi said, I mentioned to him yesterday very well at one of the seminars, something to the effect that one can't impose democracy, but what one can do is provide the music and the candles and the flowers. The problem is folks come along who want to scratch the record and silence the music and crush and cut the flowers. They're called dictators. And in the course of the 20th century, there were five huge, powerful empires, one authoritarian, four totalitarian. The German imperialists of the early part of the century, the Nazis, the fascists, the Japanese Empire, and the communists of the Soviet Union. All of those were effectively defeated by democracies in arms. The Soviets defeated by democracies in arms, happily not needing to use them directly against the Soviets, but the containment and the deterrence did their job. Were any of those five major empires still around, civil liberties and human rights in the world would be a far darker prospect than it is now. Those were ended. Four of them, as I said, by force of arms, the other by deterrence and containment, very heavily by involvement of the world's democracies in struggling against them. Sometimes they struggled stupidly. Some of the authoritarian regimes we backed during the Cold War, we probably didn't need to. Sometimes in desperation, we made common cause with them. The United States was a close ally and major funder for 4 years of history's greatest murderer at that point, Joseph Stalin, because we needed him against the Nazis. And had Stalin invaded Europe after World War II, he would have rolled on wheels made in Detroit. So sometimes one has to do what one has to do. Sometimes one does it wisely. Sometimes one does it stupidly. I feel no sense that it is always right to use or prepare to use force against authoritarians or dictators. But I think it's important that sometimes one needs to, and quite frequently when one does, information and holding information, sometimes keeping information secret, is an important part of that. It's not always the case. You're a moderator today, for example, in 1967-68 was the founder and president of Yale Citizens for Eugene McCarthy for president. I'm probably the only former CIA director who was ever a leader of an anti-war movement. We all do what we think we need to do at the time. But this balance between sometimes secrecy and sometimes force in the interests of moving the world 100 democracies closer to freedom, and sometimes self-criticism, sometimes struggle against even a democratic government that is maintaining secrecy unnecessarily, is a real tension. It's a real tension which is not a one-sided matter. It's a real tension which we have to work out every day. We've been working it out in this country ever since the Alien and Sedition Acts, and we've done it time and again, as I say, sometimes wisely, sometimes stupidly. But it's a real two-sided struggle. There's not just one side to it. I'd like to throw the...
I'd like to ask the panel something, just a slight preface. When we went to Berlin for the first time a couple of years ago, I went to the Jewish Museum, the new one. One of the most sobering aspects of it, far more so than reading it in books, was the realization as you walk through how rapidly the Holocaust happened. And you walk out of the museum with the understanding that advanced Western societies, governments, are constructed to move slowly, to have balance. And so they're not very well equipped necessarily to react to this rapid consolidation of power. Philip Roth's Plot Against America was in some ways a satirical, but in some ways an extremely devastating kind of application of that principle in the United States. One of the things that's intriguing about the information era we're living in, the post-industrial era, is things move much more rapidly than ever before. So I'm wondering what you believe. You said that that allows us to consolidate opposition, to flow opposition much more rapidly. But I'm wondering if the opposite also holds true, whether there are higher risks now for totalitarian or authoritarian movements to just rapidly consolidate mobs and move more quickly than in the past. So that's question number one. And question number two is, given what you think, reflect back on Philip Roth's book, and can you address the question of, could anything like that happen here?
Just so people know, Lindbergh is elected in 1940? As a pro-Nazi a fascist in Roth's book. Samantha, why don't you take the first one if you like?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think to start, I just want to come back to Mike's point, which is that democracies don't take on these issues, promoting human rights, protecting human rights, enforcing human rights, stopping genocide, eagerly. And what makes democracies different is that domestic political constituencies can navigate their way through the system. Most of the great human rights advances that have come about in a sort of technically a top-down way in the U.S. government over the last 40 or 50 years have come about not through the executive branch saying, oh, let's have country reports on human rights. Let's have our State Department, you know, go out and figure out what's going on and who's whacking whom in China or anyplace else. It's because of congressional pressure. And those congressional representatives who are more rooted in their communities are more connected to those people with the amnesty candles on their fridge and you know, just more in touch with what citizens want America to stand for in the non, you know, narrow national interest sense. So to your question, as a result of given that executive branches tend to be kind of roped into it, tend to back into it, that is a very slow process to get the polis activated in time. And like you're suggesting, and I always find myself saying this to colleagues all the time, you know, why is it the bad guys are always so much better at being bad than we are at being good? You know, why do we suck at being good? You know, and they're so, well, because they want it more. They don't have the same collective action problems. They're not democracies for the most part if they're committing these kinds of crimes. They have smaller decision-making bodies and so on. So take Rwanda, where everybody, you know, it's the sort of poster child for how could it be
that 800,000 people could have been exterminated with the good guys in office, you know, the people who weren't ashamed to say that human rights could be conceivably part of the national interest. How could that be? And the answer is, well, I mean, there are lots of answers, but one is that you have to look upstream. You know, to what degree is your bureaucracy attentive to a country like Rwanda prior to things hitting the fan? Because then you'll know whether your intelligence assets are in place or whether you have, you know, operatives on the ground that you trust, whether you know a society so you have confidence in your judgment in the moment. And so you have to look upstream as to the relevance of these kinds of societies. And a lot of the places where people are about to be genocided or being abused are not countries that have intrinsic strategic import to the United States. So you don't have those sort of front-end resources. Then you ask, well, okay, so how could Rwanda have been put on the map? And not just put on the map, but how could it have been put on the map in a timely fashion, and how could it have that sort of timely mobilized constituency have overridden the ghost of Somalia, which was 6 months, you know, previously. So it's like putting an extra burden on a domestic constituent. You don't have to just alert the policymakers to the fact that people are dying in Rwanda and it matters to you as citizens. You have to alert them that it matters to you as citizens such that you'd be willing to endure casualties in a way that, you know, the administration has convinced itself that you weren't willing to endure them just 6 months before. So suddenly you're talking about, okay, you got to mobilize networks. And one of the things that especially in progressive America, on the right, in the religious right especially, there's a seamlessness between those who do pro-life work domestically and those who activate on a moment's notice around, you know, family planning issues and abortion funding and so on abroad. On the progressive side, there's much more of a stovepiping between people who do civil rights work and people who do, you know, international human rights work. So until very recently, Mike, I mean, I think you'd agree with this, and Mike struggled with this as in running lawyers committee, we were all sort of groping to find natural foot soldiers domestically who could kick into gear at a moment's notice, at a time of crisis, in order to override the governmental disposition not to do anything about the thing. And 100 days of a Rwandan genocide did not afford, you know, a student network time to sort of kick into gear, Jewish groups to understand that this was enough like the Holocaust that it would, you know, move them in that way, evangelicals to remember their missionary work. And, Darfur is an example of how long it takes. And that movement is kicking into gear, but it is literally, you know, I mean, again, 300,000 people dead before we had our first rally on the Mall.
But what I'm taking from you, just to press the point, is that the new and increasing, I'm going to provoke to get
sure.
a response, the new increasing, increasingly rapid decentralization of information makes it easier to consolidate terror than to mobilize a response. That's what I'm wondering about. We used to think about this. Rwanda comes to us as an example of, you know, hate radio and of some mass media consolidation. But I'm wondering whether decentralized internet-based information makes it easier to mobilize a response or to consolidate terror.
Mike, why don't you take that?
You know, I think it does both. I think it does both probably at the same speed. One of the things I would say to your second question more broadly is I'm really an optimist. I'm a professional optimist. I believe that this is a society that has lots of ways to protect against the kind of thing you're describing that happened in Germany. And I've seen it graphically in the fight we've had. We've been in the center of the fight to stop United States soldiers and intelligence agents from torturing people. That was not an easy fight at the beginning. After 9/11, the country was scared, and the administration, some people in the administration, took advantage of that to play with basic fundamental concepts of human rights and liberty. But over time, the NGO community kicked in, the press, the military has been phenomenal at all levels, up and down the chain. Information is coming out of places where things are going on by soldiers who are unhappy with what they see. They're using new technology to get it out. We saw the pictures from Abu Ghraib. It's not an accident. There were a lot of unhappy soldiers who said, we got to stir the pot here. And then finally the Congress, Senator McCain and others, the courts. We have a lot of pretty vibrant institutions in this society. So when the early days of the administration, they said it's not patriotic to challenge what we're doing, you're with us, you're against us. You're with us, you're for the terrorists. That's not the way we operate. I'm a patriot. I'm a patriot as much as anybody in the administration. And my job is to raise the alarm when they're doing something wrong. And our society, I think, is responding the way it should.
Chiming in on one point. I think that it is, and I was part of the decision-making mechanism back then, I think it is impossible to over...
in 1993, 94.
I think it's impossible to overestimate the impact of Mogadishu and Black Hawk Down on the administration's decision making, both about Rwanda and about Bosnia. It took a lot longer than it should have. It had to have Srebrenica before intervened in Bosnia. But the general spirit of, hey, we can send some armed forces over there and get things sorted out, was really effectively gelded by Black Hawk Down in October of 93. We had a question, Mickey.
I'd like to respond from the perspective of Zimbabwe. And I can say rather briskly that the availability of technology has been used far more effectively by human rights organizations than the regime has been able to use. I used the example of last year's so-called Operation Muramatsuna, the clean-out campaign that resulted in 700,000 people being displaced from their homes. It was the images that human rights organizations were able to send to the United Nations and elsewhere that actually stopped that process in its tracks. Had we not had that technology available to us, I have no doubt it would have gone on for much longer. To illustrate the point, even further, I think if you compare the situation in Zimbabwe against, for example, what's going on in Congo, you can see that we've been able to ameliorate human rights abuses in Zimbabwe through the use of technology, through using emails and digital images and so forth. And whereas, in fact, the human rights abuses in the Congo have been far worse than what is taking place in Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe has got a lot more publicity internationally because of the access to technology. And the point I want to put to the panel is, and I think it's an issue we all need to consider, is how can we get technology to these countries? How do we get technology to the Congo? Because in my view, it plays a vital role in preventing human rights abuses.
Very good point. Let me say, Randy's example to the contrary notwithstanding, I'd like people to limit themselves to one question or one point and think through what you're going to say ahead of time. I'm going to start cutting people off at about 1 minute. Question or statement is fine. And on that question to the panel?
I don't know. I mean, you know, I'm sort of intrigued by the way President Clinton is living out his post-presidential life and the kinds of partnerships he's trying to broker between, you know, the for-profit entrepreneurial world and the $100 computer that runs on a crank and the NGO community, you know, that he now spends, you know, a great portion of his time operating in. I mean, the Gateses of the world, you know, are now on the case in a new way. So just as Mike is sort of saying, you know, if you'd imagine in 1961 when Amnesty was founded with a budget of $19,000, and, you know, would we imagine that we'd be sitting with a former CIA director, you know, in Aspen, you know, not at the kiddie table anymore? You know, I would say no. And so what is the long-term fallout that we're going to see in terms of infiltration to the sort of right actors or to the right-thinking, you know, people who are struggling against repression?
There are different ways to get information in. I was chairman of the board of Freedom House for 3 years, and on my watch we had Ukraine. We ended up, and I was very proud of this, being number one on Mr. Putin's negative list, we'll say. We were the poster child. He hated us above all NGOs, at least that's that at one point. And the reason was because a couple of Freedom House people in Ukraine did something very smart. A lot of the Ukrainians in that part of Western Ukraine speak Polish, and a lot of the Poles in Eastern Poland speak Polish. Speak Ukrainian. The Polish students had a wonderful history and background and understanding of what they'd done with Solidarity. What we really did was put together a Polish-Ukrainian student group so the Polish kids could teach the Ukrainian kids what to do. And the first thing they did was go to the armed forces and say, look, we're your sons and daughters. Whatever they do, whatever they say, don't follow orders to shoot. And, you know, a lot of other people did a lot of other things, but that one was very helpful. And it came about really solely because we had a couple of people on the ground who really understood the psychology of standing up to dictators. They'd done it in Poland, and they taught the Ukrainians what to do.
Next. Yes, Steve.
I'm wondering, to follow up on some of the other questions, the changing nature of the technology where people have personal devices. We saw it with the demonstrations around the immigration question. You've talked about organizations, Freedom House, doing something, Lawyers Committee triggering or having a constituency that you mobilize. Push that one step further and talk about the nature of the organization, how the organizing concept changes as you go less from a top-down or even a networking based at an organization to a very different kind of organization given the nature of the technology where people contact each other not through a human rights organization of standing. Is there an implication here that we should be thinking about as this technology changes?
Michael, or Charlie?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is already beginning to be a democratization of communication because of technology. I think that's part of what you're suggesting. It used to be that you had to have an office and you had to know how to mail things in or do whatever to make those connections. Now it's just the norm that people are, you know, in 15 or 20 countries having a conversation about a common problem. They may or may not be part of an organized human rights organization. And one thing that's striking, when I started doing this work, there were maybe a dozen human rights organizations operating nationally outside of the southern cone of Latin America and South Africa and the Philippines and India and a few other places. Now you really would have to look hard to see, but I would bet there are less than 10 countries in the world where somebody isn't doing human rights work. Some of them are organized, and some of them are individual operators who are just out there trying to figure out what to do. And they have a lot more ability to talk with one another. And that communication, often between people who are in more similar situations, is probably a more important kind of communication in terms of what do we do now, and are there lessons learned, than anything that we could provide them from New York or from London. So I think there is a huge amount of communication going on now all the time among a very diverse group of people in a range of countries that we wouldn't have seen it 10 years ago.
Question in the back, and then next here.
Could you please comment on the role of the UN in human rights? I know the U.S. decided not to participate in the panel and take a seat on the human rights group. And also some of the failures the UN has had, like responding to Darfur quickly and mobilizing something to stop there. I'd like to hear from all three of you as well as Sashi.
You want to start?
Yeah, I'd love to. I'm actually just finishing up a book on the UN, so no topic interests me more. One of the things Richard Holbrooke likes to say about the UN is that blaming the UN for Rwanda is like blaming Madison Square Garden when the Knicks play badly. You're blaming a building. And I mean, to some degree, there's some truth to that. Shashi has written about the UN as both a stage and as an actor in its own right. And to the degree that it's a stage or the equivalent of Madison Square Garden, when the UN fails on Darfur, what is failing is, or are, the 191, now 192 with Montenegro, member states who comprise the United Nations. These are 192 countries that bring their national interests to the door. Just because they enter underneath a baby blue and white flag doesn't mean they change. It's the rare government, indeed, where policy of any kind is actually made in New York. I mean, for the most part, you're bringing instructions from your capital, and indeed those instructions are rooted in very traditional conceptions of national interests, economic interests, and security interests. So it's, you know, when you aggregate all that selfishness in one place,
not terribly pretty things happen, you know, for the most part. And if you compound that then with an executive branch for the organization, the Security Council, which has on it five permanent members, and I heard the best line on the Security Council recently was Gareth Evans described the Security Council as a body that had, among these five permanent members, Britain, France, the United States, Russia, and China, of course, are the veto wielders. And Gareth Evans described it as a body that included two 19th century powers, two 20th century powers, and one 21st century power. And sadly, the United States was not the 21st century power there. But if your executive branch, is unrepresentative, population-wise, economically, culturally, et cetera, in the way that it is, and if each of those countries have not yet decided to strengthen the UN, but actually all of them see, well, not all of them, Britain and France probably exceptional, but many of the countries see a stronger UN as a potential incursion on state interests, then more bad things are going to happen. So final point then, the UN as an actor, in spite of all of that, a number of agencies have been created over the years that do, fine humanitarian work, tend to refugees, do reconstruction and developing and development. You have peacekeeping that does manage to come about, that does manage to sort of get authorized through that clogged, often clogged Security Council. But one of the really disturbing features, I think, of the 21st century as we look ahead, unless something changes in a hurry, is that Western countries, richer countries, are increasingly opting out of doing the work of tending to common humanity. If you look back at when Jim was in government in the 1990s, when we were dealing with the Bosnians and the Rwandans, 3,000 Dutch peacekeepers were at work in some, scattered throughout, 17 UN missions at the time back in 1994. There are now 24 Dutch peacekeepers at work, in tending to places like the Congo. Similar, Canada, which allegedly invented peacekeeping in its own mind, in its own culture, has 16 United Nations military observers now at work internationally. So you have a kind of apartheid of peacekeeping that's going on where rich countries are paying for it, but it's being handed to poor countries, ever poorer countries, to go and do the actual hard work. And let's remember that the UN only gets handed anything on the actor side when there's been a market failure, when no one else wants anything to do with it. So the kinds of things, who wants to go to, if Congo were easy, some coalition of the willing would have decided to take it on. If Congo had some great economic perk, that you could legitimately extract all the minerals in them, and believe me, some number of countries would have gone to do that. They tried, in fact, in Africa. So when the UN gets handed something, chances are, your odds, even for NATO countries, would not be terribly high. And when you compound it by handing it to Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and Uruguay, you're going to see more and more failures. So until Western countries really decide to invest, or richer countries, because it would include South Africa and many Asian countries now, decide to really invest in this enterprise, you're going to see more embarrassments than not, and it'll be the baby blue and white flag that takes the hit, but it's the countries that have chosen not to invest in this institution that I think deserve far more of the blame.
Just a couple of words on your question, and I'll let it to Michael. I think that one big part of the problem is that in order to make peace, as distinct from put people in blue helmets on a line between two more or less countries or groups that are more or less decided to stand down for a time, if you want to use enforcement, you need the Security Council, and where you have things like China getting very close to Sudan in order to have access to its oil, you find that the Security Council is not going to move on Darfur, whatever the other issues the other countries may have. So there's just plain old realpolitik continues, I think, to influence human rights issues of that sort. And second is organizationally, the United States and a number of other countries, over democratic countries over the years, got rather fed up with the Human Rights Commission and with the likes of Saudi Arabia and Libya and Cuba deciding who were human rights violators, effectively. And Shashi may be able to tell me I'm wrong, but it looks to me as if they changed the name from commission to something else, and they still have effectively Saudi Arabia, Libya, Cuba, et cetera, making decisions about who's violating human rights. I think the restructuring of that human rights operation in the United Nations played directly into the hands of those in the United States Congress who say that human rights in the UN is a joke. And I'm sorry. I wish it had gone differently. I think there was a chance for real reform. I don't know why it didn't occur, but it sure looks from the membership of that operation as if it's more of what we've had before.
Let me respond.
Michael. I thought Shashi might want to say something. Michael, then Shashi, then back here.
I would just say with respect to the Human Rights Council on the point last made, I actually think the new council is better than the commission was. The commission had lots of huge number of problems. This also has problems, but it's a smaller group. Some of those bad actors are out. But more importantly, it's a body that's going to meet throughout the year. It's going to have a review of every country in the world, ultimately, beginning with the countries, the 46 countries that are members of the new council. It's not going to succeed if governments that have traditionally been the greatest supporters of human rights don't take a lead. And I was disappointed. Last week they held their first special session on Israel, focused only on Israel, not on the Palestinians. I think it's totally appropriate to focus on the things that Israel's doing wrong. But look at the whole picture. And I think the world is now going to be watching, I'm certainly going to be watching, to see, is the only special session in 2006 on Israel. Is there going to be a session on Darfur? Is there going to be a session on the Congo, on Zimbabwe? There are lots of problems in the world that deserve attention. The fact that they can meet throughout the year and have these special meetings on countries, I think, is a good sign. But we're going to have to see if that really happens. On the larger question, I think I share Samantha's view, but I would take a somewhat more critical view of the UN. It, with all of the constraints that Samantha points out, there is a moment where I think the UN Secretariat, the most senior officials in the UN, need to be less diplomatic and need to find ways to say there are certain things that are happening in the world that are just unacceptable, and we're going to find a way to say that. Darfur is an example of that. The notion that time and again, the leaders of the UN are meeting with the president of Sudan, and he keeps saying, we don't want you, let's work with the African Union. There's a point where you have to say, stop. Yeah, right. This is a guy who's, he's a bad guy, and he's never going to be willing to say, right, we want you.
Bingo.
Absolutely.
Shashi, I knew I was going to need to offer you a right of refutation. A future Secretary General deserves no less.
Well, I think both Mike and Samantha made a lot of points in agreement, but let me just briefly address two things that came up. First, on the Human Rights Council. The fact is, Jim, you are wrong on two grounds. First, on the question of composition. Because the bar was raised higher for election to the council, a majority of the members of the General Assembly having to vote for you, which wasn't the case in the commission, a lot of countries didn't even dare to run that had been on the commission. And of those who ran, some, like Iran, lost. So there is a difference on the question of composition. But second and equally important, composition is not the whole story. And in fact, Mike's already made the point. One of the most startling things, in the commission, you basically had countries getting elected in order to prevent scrutiny of their human rights records. The deal was, I will vote against a resolution scrutinizing your human rights records, if you vote against a resolution scrutinizing mine, it's basically we scratch each other's back, and we use the commission to protect ourselves. The council is exactly the opposite. By getting on the council, you guarantee scrutiny of your human rights record. It's no longer a mechanism to avoid that scrutiny. The peer review mechanism obliges every country to have its records scrutinized. So I think the council is a vast improvement, and I think you've been quite unfair as a members of Congress in overlooking both these
I hope to be proven wrong. I would say that the singling out of Israel,
just exactly the way Michael said, is a very, very bad omen. Next.
Let's hope there's more coming down the road, but I understand that.
Next.
Can I just respond to Darfur?
Sure.
I mean, on Darfur, quite simply, the response of the international community, which obviously has been focused through the UN, has actually been a three-pronged response. There has been a humanitarian response. There are 10,000 humanitarian workers from the UN and from NGOs on the ground in Darfur and across the border in Chad. So that's one thing. Take care of the victims as quickly as you can, the displaced people and so on. Second, boots on the ground. Now, yes, the AU may not be enough, but to begin with, when they were first deployed, where they were, they did make a difference. Things stopped happening in front of them. 7,000 people in a place the size of Texas. Maybe it wasn't enough. It's clear that in any case, there are further inadequacies that have come to light. But the fact is, that was the only option available. because indeed Sudan refused to accept anybody else, and there isn't a country on this planet, including your government, that's prepared to actually go to war to impose troops on Sudan that Sudan doesn't want. So we have to work with the consent of the Sudanese. And so that's the third thing was to press for a peace agreement. The AU led that effort in Abuja, Nigeria. They came up finally with a peace treaty. There were problems. Some of the rebel groups didn't like it. This issue is part of the problem. But unless you have an effective peace that can be kept, you don't really have effective peacekeeping. And as I said, no one seems to be interested in any case in war making. So it's peacekeeping you want to do. Clearly the UN can do it better than just the African Union. The African Union has been brave, and I'm glad these 7,000 folks are out there, but you obviously need resources, you need troops, you need money from other countries. And the UN can do that, provided there is a viable peace it can uphold. Right now, that viable peace doesn't fully exist, and the agreement is fraying at the edges already. So it's a little more complex than just saying bad things are happening, go out and stop them. We have, I mean, I must say, Mike, you do know that the first person internationally to make a huge fuss about Darfur was Kofi Annan, followed by Yann Epa. 2 years ago at the Human Rights Commission on the 10th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide, he did draw attention to the atrocities in Darfur, and we've not stopped talking about it since. It's not that we've been diplomatic. But what do we do? Denouncing the president of Sudan gets us exactly where? How are we going to make one person safer in Darfur by doing that?
Well, can I answer that?
Sure.
I think you start by saying that there are, you know, Sudan is almost a textbook example of governments, all kinds of governments, acting in their own narrow self-interest, and you need to start calling them on it. The Chinese, 80-90% of their oil is coming from Sudan. It's 10% of 90% of Sudan's oil is going to China. It's 10% of China's oil imports. The Chinese have defended the Sudanese like crazy. The UN never says that. The Russians, the French with Alf Total, the South Africans doing business in the south of Sudan. Where's the public comment on that? It doesn't happen. And the conversations with Bashir, including the one earlier this week, are just too damn polite. There has to be a sense, and there needs to be a diplomatic ratcheting up of the process. I don't agree that you can say that the AU forces are doing anywhere near enough. They don't have the right mandate. They don't have the capacity.
Mobility.
And it's not going to happen unless the UN and the U.S. and other powerful governments say enough is enough.
Shashi, a very brief response if you want, then we're going here.
Look, you know, Mike's making a very valid point. My answer ultimately is, okay, so you do all of this, and then what? You're still not going to get in to protect these people without the consent and cooperation of the Sudanese government. So ultimately, that's the political reality in which we're working.
You have to start by telling your truth.
Yeah, defer. You defer to a political reality. You have no chance of shaping it.
And
I mean, if you give into it before you've even tried. I mean, we've tried this quiet diplomacy. We've tried the sputtering of diplomacy.
And
let's try a little loud diplomacy.
One final little point. Given China's position on this issue, which will not change, the only way one would be able to use force against the Sudanese government, against the Janjaweed, would be a coalition of the willing.
Willing.
You've heard the phrase before.
Willing to do what?
Use force. Use the force.
Right,
of course.
Yeah,
of course. Of course. If you want to stop the Janjaweed, you have to use force.
I'd like to know who the candidates are for this coalition.
Well, I've got one, but I don't think they would go along with it. We had here. Yes, ma'am.
To the gentleman over there, we sent computers to Liberia. They didn't have one in their university. We just got them from, there's a Christina agency in New York, and from Merrill Lynch and other organizations that when a new person comes in, a new person gets a new computer. The big expense is to send it there. You also may want to check the World Youth Leadership Network because we're bringing them into West Africa. As well, but and it's just a lot of grassroots people doing it as well as this other agency. But my other question was related to his, which
sure.
is in the ideal world, how do you create laws? Laws are only as good as the people who are pushing them, but how would you create what Eleanor Roosevelt did, the next step at the UN, where you say we are going to either use NATO or we're going to support coalition and help the AU, but we will not accept that this, you know, when a government is killing its people, that they don't want anybody in there. What is there, there's got to be a next step that at least goes on the books.
Samantha, why don't you say a word or two on that, and then we'll look.
Well, I mean, I think we're, frankly, I'm all normed out on the issue of atrocity.
And I think another problem is that CNN used to give more attention to the rest of the world. Now we hardly know. CNN in Europe is a little bit better. The BBC in Europe is better. But you don't. How do you get the news people to highlight the things that you're trying to do? And so we apparently Ethiopia, the new leader there is, the U.S. is supporting him because he's an anti-terrorist, but he's killing his own people. We don't even know that.
I'm going to move on. Yes.
I work for Boutros Ghali, and I lived at the residence for 6 months. And I'm Jewish, and I deplore how the United Nations treats Israel. But I must say that the United Nations is the most extraordinary place I've ever seen in my life. We have to remember, first of all, we have 191 different countries under one roof. Now that's simply extraordinary. And the fact that these people are meeting each other and have relationships with each other in the rest of the world is an extraordinary measure. Secondly, living at the residence, I had the extraordinary privilege of learning what you will be facing. First of all, you'll get no sleep because your constituency is around the world. It's 24 hours a day, and the phone will be ringing constantly. But there are more fires that are put out by the United Nations that could potentially develop into Darfur's and Rwanda's that are put out because two people who may not even speak the same language but live side by side have no place else to go, can go to the United Nations, can go to the Secretary General, and can sit in his living room at 3 o'clock in the morning and discuss a problem. And the problem may just amount, and the problem may have amounted to something such as mass killings, and it all evolved around the fact that somebody else's grass was growing on that part of the country, and it shouldn't be growing. And so, given all its bad, awful things, I think the United Nations is just a marvelous
thing. Earl?
You know, one problem, I mean, we seem to get down through all the laws, through all the good intentions, down to the point you raised, Jim, is there are times when a coalition really must assemble. There's no one else to do it. And I think one of the great tragedies that we confront now is that great exercise in the willing forming a coalition, of course, is an utter disaster in Iraq. And it will be a long, long time before I think the United States or anyone else will take that very kind of bold step to go into a place like Darfur or any other place. And so in a certain sense, we had our chance. And the United States is the logical country with the power that it does have to lead such enterprises. But I don't see that being a very likely prospect in the future for any other place.
But more than that, the collateral effect, the collateral damage of Iraq on American summoning power.
Yes.
Because the United States wasn't going to Rwanda either for separate reasons. You know, we always have, you know, we weren't going to go deal with the Khmer Rouge because of Vietnam, we won't deal with Rwanda because of Somalia, we won't deal with Darfur because of Iraq. We get into trouble in places and it tends to spook us. But we have had a certain standing and an ability to agree to pay for and to rally troops from other countries.
Right.
And other countries are invoking Iraq as well as their own alibi for staying home.
Well, it spooks us. It's a double-barreled jeopardy. It spooks us into being unwilling. And it deranges anyone else who might be of a mind to join with us because it would be a somewhat unholy alliance at this point.
So right.
Lydia in the pink right here. And why don't both of you have right here have 1 minute or less, and you also 1 minute or less, and then we'll let the panel discuss those three, and then I'm afraid that's it. Yes, ma'am.
So actually, my question is directed to you. As a lead at Freedom House and a lead at the CIA, you made a comment that we had to have in our tool chest force of arms, deterrence, and containment, and you said to help. And I wondered, as a thoughtful player in all of this, what your criteria might be to advance human rights, taking Orville's question on how do you now become part of the coalition of the willing to stop enormous global abuses?
Doing best. Jess?
Yes, I understand that the five nations of the UN Security Council are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the top five suppliers of arms to the world, and that includes dictatorships, rebel groups, etc. That's problematic, in my opinion. I'd love your opinion on it.
Back.
Yeah, I share a lot of the concerns about the UN Human Rights Council, and especially their decision to start with Israel as what they see as the biggest abuser. But my own belief is that America needs to be involved in the conversation, and I, at least, was terribly disappointed that after writing a lot of letters and things like that to Bolton, there was not an American diplomat at a high level at the discussions about what that UN Human Rights Council would look like, and started out actually with a two-thirds requirement and moved down to a majority, and that we then decided after Eleanor Roosevelt's leadership not to even decide to go on to that council. And I'm just curious what the panel thinks about, even if we disagree with the council as the most effective mechanism, if we think in a time of terror, the U.S. should be essentially staying silent in that international forum, or should we be trying to stand up for Israel and trying to bring up Darfur by taking a seat at a council that we may not wholly agree with, because that's kind of the way that international politics works.
Samantha, why don't you come in? No.
Well, both the, and yeah, because you have Nancy's to respond to,
right.
But I think both the questions sort of hint at anyway the issue of legitimacy. I mean, your question about who are these five overlords, the five policemen from 1945, to be the ones to decide when a threat to international peace and security rises to the level to warrant outside intervention, whether diplomatic, economic, or military, if these are the same guys, you know, pumping arms into these kinds of places. And the discrediting of the UN, which the United States had a kind of monopoly on, you know, propagating that, you know, sort of the UN as enemy, the UN as threat, the UN as sort of nepotistic, corrupt place. I mean, that lack of legitimacy of the UN is now spreading. I mean, that impression of the UN into the developing world, and one of the reasons is a sense that it's not representative, the Security Council, and that none of the countries themselves are living up to the principles within the UN Charter. Now, the same states who are making that argument would themselves be eager to receive many of those arms and are themselves human rights abusers. So there's a lot of very selective application of principle that goes on in international settings. But I mean, to the second question, you know, one of the most disturbing things that I've heard in the last few years is from Luis Moreno Ocampo, who's the prosecutor of the ICC. And one of the things he said, you know, we're all in, well, I don't know about this room, but I would imagine this room is sort of self-selecting, and many of us anyway would like to see the United States be at least a friend of the court, you know, and wish this court well so that it could have a role in preventing these kinds of atrocities in the future. Luis will tell you the best thing that, off the record, that the best thing that ever happened to the court is that the United States came out and in opposition to it. Because if the United States were playing full on in the way that it tends to play in international institutions, namely by controlling them or by playing by observing rules that it gets to shape, then how could the ICC be actually carrying out investigations in the Congo, in Darfur, in Ivory Coast, in other places? It would be seen in the developing world as a tool of the American agenda or American imperialism. So for the time being, to have the United States trashing the court, especially this United States that has lost so much legitimacy over the last 5 years, is actually a boon to the credibility of the court. And the irony of the UN Human Rights Council, and you made a very important point, which is that Bolton did what Bolton does, which is he didn't do any diplomacy behind the scenes and then sort of showed up and said, this is the Human Rights Council we want. Why isn't everybody going along with the United States? The UN is corrupt. Everybody wants abusers on the court. It's like, well, no, actually, one of the reasons is diplomacy actually means doing kind of, you know, groundwork before you show up, and it's not about diktat. But one of the amazing things about even the kind of the council that is imperfect, I think we'd all, even those of us who think it's an improvement, agree that it's imperfect, but that would have been very, very hard to get through. There were a lot of spoiler G77 countries who did not want this council, but with those rules, because it was going to exclude a lot of abusers in the developing world.
And the only reason they turned in favor of the council is when Bolton came out and said he was in opposition to it. So if that's the world we live in, where the ICC and the Human Rights Council are perversely, you know, better off, then we have to come back, and then again gets to the prior question, which is that the member states who are the engines for these principles have to get their own houses in order to be voices for these principles in these international bodies. And so it's like turtles all the way down. It comes back to mobilization, domestic politics, and us convincing our governments, you know, that it's in the interest of our citizens for us to restore that legitimacy and then play within these bodies in ways that can be useful.
Just two quick comments. I happened to be in the, I was in the National Security Council the day that they were deciding whether or not to run for a seat on the council. And there were people in the NSC, and it may have been the dominant view that prevailed, that said, if we run, we're going to lose. We're taking soundings, and we don't really think we're going to get the votes. That's an unbelievable state of affairs. And it reflects something of what Samantha's saying. The dynamic in the world has become incredibly poisonous. Now, having said that, my reaction to them was, even if you run and you lose, you got to get in there and try to be a force for whatever, you know, principles the United States historically has stood for. I really don't believe that either the UN or the world are going to succeed on major human rights crises unless the US and the UN learn to talk to one another. We've been trying for the last 6 months to get a UN envoy appointed on Darfur who focuses on Darfur, a very high-level diplomat. And I can tell you that the conversations in the U.S. government with people like Mike Gerson, who cares about this, and Zelik and others, they're absolutely so ideologically and just emotionally opposed to the U.N. The notion of working with the U.N. in a way that makes the U.N. look good, they can't contemplate what that would look like. And on the other side, when you go to talk to people in the U.N. and say, how about working with the U.S.? How about appointing a senior U.S. somebody to be your Darfur envoy? That's a win-win. The reaction is, why would we make the United States look good? We have got to fix that. It's a problem. It's a problem in both sides of the house. And unless we fix it, we can talk all we want about Darfur and the crises of the day. They're not going to be fixed. The rest of the world is not going to take the lead in those sorts of situations. And with the United States absent, we face the consequence that all of us want to avoid.
Two quick responses, one on the arms trade and the other on the criteria about stopping abuses. The world is going to trade arms. The question seems to me to be, is who do you sell them to? And of the five permanent members of the Security Council, China's not really an arms exporter except sometimes in the past to a rogue regime here and there, and they probably helped the Saudis set up their ballistic missile program some years ago. Russia, I think, has the distinction of selling to the worst governments. France, it's kind of a mix, and Americans and Brits certainly sell overseas. But I think what I think one wants to focus on is who is being armed. Because the world in one way or another is probably going to arm itself. The question is, are you selling to dictatorships or not? And I think that set of criteria, which got rather distorted for the United States and Britain back during the Cold War, is a perfectly reasonable one to try to use international institutions and others to enforce now. As far as I'm concerned, the really bad actor in the international arms trade right now is Russia. The second thing is criteria. As long as using force under international authority is defined as Security Council approval, that means that the five permanent members have to support it. And under the current circumstances, in something like Darfur, that is not going to happen. China will not do it. There may be some change in circumstances over the years that would change that. It won't happen. The Clinton administration went to war twice with Milosevic, neither time under Security Council authorization, once over Bosnia, once over Kosovo. I think the model, probably, of Kosovo is the one we are going to have to see in the future. It may be the United States, it may be someone else, But what we did in Kosovo was we went informally to the Security Council and we said, anybody going to veto? And the Russians said, yeah, we're going to veto. And we said, okay, forget that. And we went to NATO. We pulled NATO together, and NATO effectively did what it did in Kosovo, which I think was the right thing to do. Personally, I would have liked to have seen it happen sooner. I would have liked to have seen us intervene on behalf of the Bosnians against the Serbs sooner. You can't have a world in which the United States itself alone, or with just one or two other countries, goes around bashing folks. One has to have some set of criteria and some set of international processes. But if you want genocides stopped, and if you want it only done by international forces under the authority of the Security Council, you want to, at the present time, you want two completely conflicting things. And the first path of wisdom, I think, is to admit that. Now, Shashi will be appalled, but I was actually asked back in 1992 to chair a panel for the UN Association of the United States. And we had a bunch of retired military people on it, and we looked at what one might do. Those were days in which we thought maybe we'd have more Russian and Chinese cooperation than has turned out to be the case. One thing we thought was ineffective was trying to fight with a peacekeeping model. If you're going to have to use force effectively, you will not do it by having a platoon of Ghanaians and a platoon from Nigeria, a platoon from New Zealand, a platoon from Canada, and so forth. Military units fight essentially as a brigade, a lot of times as a division. Air forces fight as wings. You have to have a coherent force of maybe a couple of brigades or a division and some air attached to it that can fight. What we came up with was the notion that we would have one representative country from what might have been called the first world in the old days and one from the third world, and we would let them train, and the United Nations, through contributions, would support their training and cooperation, put together a brigade and a wing of air. The United States could provide the logistics, intelligence, the support mechanisms, and so forth. And our first two choices were Britain and Nepal, because the Brits and the Gurkhas have a rather long and effective tradition of being able to use force. Nepal has been off on a frolic of its own recently and possibly is not available. But the concept of having a standing force able for the Security Council able to be used, it consists of real professional soldiers that could actually fight and not just be symbols from different countries, strikes me as a useful idea. It also, however, still today would crack up on the rocks of largely Chinese or Russian opposition to intervening in some place like Darfur. I'm afraid with that, we're 10 minutes over. Going to have to close it off. Thank you.